everyone, and welcome back to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we're taking a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Nisch. I'm a professor of earth sciences at Western University, a planetary geologist, and a fan of science fiction.
And I'm Dr. John Moores, a professor of space engineering here at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, and a speculative fiction nerd. And for every one of these episodes, Catherine and I are going to take some turns picking out a movie or a television show to analyze. And this week, I got to make a selection. So today, we're going to be discussing the movie Ender's Game.
Now, the problem was simple. How do you slingshot your forces into an attack position on the blind side of this moon using the gravitational pull from this planet? This is basic rocket science, people.
So we're starting things off with titles that are near and dear to our hearts. Last week, we took a look at a couple of X-Files episodes that Catherine listened to when she was young. And today we're examining one of my favorite books as a child, Ender's Game, and the science within it. So Ender's Game tells the story of a very young boy whose talents select him to join an elite military training academy to help humanity face an existential threat. But of course, things turn out a little bit different than you might imagine. And there's a big twist at the end of this one. I wonder if I should bother spoiling it. I think everyone probably knows. But before we get there, and I'm sure we will, why don't we talk a little bit about some of the science challenges that we had with this one? So I know so many of these movies have aliens attacking us. And even that is a little bit far-fetched in some respects. I mean, this is something I think you've thought about a fair bit, Catherine.
You always wonder if aliens are smart enough to invent interstellar travel and reach other planets, would they be the sort of alien that would want to attack you? So this is something, you know, that I don't think is addressed very well in any movie I've seen, with the perhaps the exception of Contact, a book turned into a movie by Carl Sagan. And it comes down to this question of how long do advanced civilizations last, you know, before they end up destroying themselves? Which is something, you know, as humans, we are actively contemplating with the threat of war, with climate change, with other, you know, threats to our civilizations. And there's one way of actually quantifying this. There was a scientist named Frank Drake who was trying to figure out how many intelligent civilizations there might be in the galaxy. And this, he has this really interesting equation, which you can look up, called the Drake equation. And there's a lot of different factors in it to give you kind of an estimate of how many intelligent beings there might be in the galaxy. And some of these are things we can observe, like how many stars have planets, what's the rate of star formation of the galaxy. But at the very end, there's this very interesting term, which is the length of time for which a civilization will actually release a signal into space. For humans, it's been about 100 years. You know, back to the days when we first started transmitting television signals around the world with radio waves. But, you know, if we do die off due to some war or climate change, you know, that number might not last very long. And clearly, we have not advanced very far towards stellar exploration. Probably this number has to be pretty big if you're actually going to invent interstellar travel and then take the time to actually go and visit other solar systems.
Something I really love with this equation is the functional definition of an intelligent civilization as a group of beings capable of building a radio telescope. You know, that is so perfect because, of course, we can't really see people otherwise. One of the really fascinating things about that as well is how long do you expect such a civilization to be broadcasting by radio? You mentioned it's been about 100 years for us, but we're a lot more radio quiet now than we used to be.
That's a fair point. So maybe this term is not the best one to use. Maybe it's very anthropogenic, you know, this conceit that other species would want to transmit stuff via radio into space. But I think the point still stands that you have to have an advanced civilization last for a long enough time to produce, you know, the sorts of technology that you'd need to visit other worlds. And so this whole concept of aliens attacking other planets seems a bit counterintuitive, because if you're so violent, want to attack other planets, wouldn't you just attack yourself first and kill everybody off? And so I tend to think that if aliens were to visit us, they'd be a much more peaceful sort of society that would not be interested in attacking us. So the question is, why did these aliens attack in Ender's Game? You know, were they, you know, violent and trying to destroy another life form, us here on Earth? Or did they fundamentally misunderstand what was going on? Maybe they didn't realize that we were sentient beings and we're just trying to find a new place to live. And they do address this a little bit in the movie and the book. But still, I hate this trope of aliens coming to Earth and attacking us. I think that's extremely unlikely to happen.
And I think with this particular trope, we always hear in the movies people talking about resource extraction as the reason, because that might have been true during the age of maritime exploration here on the Earth, but the distances are so far. It's so hard even to get off your own planet, let alone go to another solar system, that it just seems laughable that the reason to do that would be, you know, to get some kind of resource. There's just nothing that is that valuable other than, you know, the information and the science. So you mentioned contact, where it's the ability to communicate with other species, to, you know, learn from them, exchange information. That's the valuable thing. Whereas Ender's Game falls into the same trap that so many other of these types of movies do, where, you know, it's like the aliens are here for water, the most cosmically abundant substance in the universe. But apparently they need to come and attack us for that. Now, I will give you an Ender's Game that it is offhand by one character, which to me makes it sound more like this particular character just doesn't care, rather than other movies where it is very clear, you know, they are there for water or something else like that.
I mean, even if they were just looking for another habitable planet to colonize, as John says, the distance between solar systems is enormous. The nearest solar system to us is 4 light years away. So unless you invent some faster than light travel, which, you know, would defy physics as we know it, there's no way to get between solar systems in any reasonable amount of time. So probably you would look to other planets within your own solar system to inhabit, you know, as people are talking about today, looking at Mars as a potential place for human life. So it does seem kind of unrealistic. The other topic, speaking of the aliens, is the form that they take. So they compare them to ants in this movie. They do look like insects in the movie. But when I was looking at these insects in the movie, I was trying to think, would you actually grow an insect that large? They're larger than humans. There's a scene at the end where the formic queen is talking to Ender and she's like 3 or 4 times his size. That's an enormous insect. So I did a little research to see if bugs on Earth could grow that big. And it sounds like the answer is no. At least, you know, insects that have evolved on Earth, the largest one that we know of occurred in the late Permian about 275 million years ago. It was a dragonfly that had a wingspan of 2.5 feet and weighed over 1 pound. So that's a pretty big insect. I would not want to encounter this, you know, on a hike in the woods, but it's nowhere near being, you know, 2 meters tall and 3 meters long. And it turns out we don't exactly know why insects are limited in size on Earth. But one idea is that the way that they intake oxygen is different than humans. And so it might be very difficult to get oxygen to insects as they grow bigger and bigger through these tubes they have throughout their bodies. And so without a lot of oxygen, you know, insects might be limited in size. And so it makes it even more unrealistic since the planet that Ender and the Formic are talking on is really low in oxygen. They make that point in the movie. Ender has to bring an oxygen tank along with him to talk to this queen. So unless they had a very different evolutionary history that's very different from our insects, you know, it seems unlikely you'd get an insect growing that large.
It is really fascinating, the point that you bring up, that you can actually look back through Earth history, look at the oxygen levels, and actually track the size of insects almost as a proxy for the amount and the concentration of oxygen you have in the atmosphere. But I'm going to jump off of your final point there just a little bit. The idea that just because one thing looks like another thing doesn't necessarily mean that it's composed of the same parts. And of, you know, thinking about life originating somewhere else. If you're from another solar system, you're probably a different genesis than ours. Just thinking about, you know, would we expect any of the same sorts of internal structures? So there's this idea of convergent evolution that, of course, biology goes and solves similar problems in similar ways. And, you know, even thinking about like the little tubes and the ways of getting oxygen in through the skin, I have to wonder if, you know, you could go down an evolutionary pathway where maybe those air exchanging pathways get brought inside the body. Perhaps, you know, you get something a little bit like lungs. So it's a fun problem, I think, from a biological point of view. In the movie, I feel like it's a little bit of a shorthand, right? These are, you know, scary creatures, and that it's really, we need something that we know in order to be afraid of it. If something was completely unlike any of the forms that we saw, you know, it might not trigger that kind of a visceral reaction in the audience, I don't think.
Yes. I mean, the issue is we're not very creative, right? So aliens either look exactly like humans with like a funny forehead or, you know, like something we're scared of, like an insect or a monster. But in truth, I think we're just not creative enough to really understand what life on other planets might look like. You know, we have some thought that life probably needs carbon-based molecules and perhaps water as a solvent. But beyond that, there's a lot of different possibilities that life could take. And I think since we haven't ever encountered another life form other than those on Earth, it's really hard for us to imagine anything outside of our own experience.
So I'd like to jump us to another very, very popular space movie trope, and that's asteroid belts. Whenever there are asteroid belts in movies, I'm looking at you, Star Wars. The asteroids are always shown extremely close together. And in our own asteroid belt, the individual objects are really, really isolated. I mean, the average distance between these things is almost 1 million kilometers or 600,000 miles or so. And yet, again, when we get into the Formic solar system, we're presented with some very tight together asteroids. I mean, it is more dramatic, definitely. But, you know, realism, it's a good question.
Yeah, the only other thought I had is maybe they're planetary rings. And so if you look at Saturn's rings, those particles can be quite close together, maybe 10 meters apart. But if all of these are rings, that's a whole lot of rings. We only see one substantial ring in our solar system. There are faint rings around all of the giant planets, but Saturn's the only one, you know, that looked anything like what they showed in this movie. And it's just, I don't think it's that common.
They don't last long.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, go ahead, John. Yeah, they don't last very long.
Yeah, these are short-lived things. You know, Saturn may not have always looked the way that it does today. I'm so tempted to say, but asteroids are forever. They last quite a bit longer in terms of solar system history. But yeah, these interesting little dynamical problems do tend to work themselves out with time. There are theories that Saturn's rings will recollect themselves into a moon over time.
But probably not a good place to fight an intergalactic war. You're probably not going to crush two rocks together to kill a Formic.
Well, fortunately for that, they had a magic weapon called the Little Doctor, which eliminated that ring system for them.
Yeah, that was kind of a hard weapon to believe. I mean, every sci-fi movie has something like this, some magic weapon that just, you know, solves all the plot holes and complexities by killing everything. So that was a little disappointing. I think they did briefly try to explain the science, but it's not a terribly realistic sort of weapon.
How do you feel about those things in general? Because with science fiction, you're always going to have, I mean, the name for this kind of plot device in a movie is a MacGuffin, something mm-hmm. that allows the action to take place, but that isn't really integral to the story. And I feel like in sci-fi in particular, we really pick on these things.
I'm not opposed to it. Obviously, you know, it is fiction, right? You've got to maybe have a little bit of flexibility there in order to write a fun story. But I always like it better when there's at least some semblance of a scientific explanation for it. You know, it makes it a little bit more real for me, where if it's just sort of a magical tool, it delves more into fantasy and less science fiction for me.
Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes I feel like if the natural world is too boring, it's because the artist hasn't thought long and hard enough about it. one of my favorite books actually takes the time required, the relativistic time dilation between, and in fact, a number of authors do this, between solar systems, and uses that to really, really crushing effect. So one book to which Ender's Game sometimes gets compared, like The Forever War by Joe Haldeman, is an example of that. So let's talk a little bit about the central set piece of the book and of the movie, which is that battle room. And I think, you know, some of the physics in this movie is well done, but there are definitely some places where things are skirted a little bit. And I think that you had an issue with that door.
Yeah, this really took me out of the movie. So they go to great lengths to show, you know, the generation of artificial gravity on the space station. And that actually they did pretty well. And I'll talk about that a bit later. But once you get into this battle room, you go from full gravity and jump through a door into zero gravity, which is unrealistic, right? At least not the way that they've presented it. The way they're generating the gravity is to rotate a cylinder in order to impose a centripetal force, which will, you know, trap people's feet to the floor. But that door was not rotating. They just jump straight from zero G to 1G and back again with no real explanation for how that's happening.
Yeah, you could imagine maybe there's, again, another gravity generation MacGuffin type thing in the floor. But if they've got that there, why rotate the rest of the space station? And even though you could set it up where you go from 1G into zero gravity, it would not be fun because you still have all of your momentum. You would be headed into that wall very quickly.
And probably disoriented and maybe a little nauseous, you know, because you're rotating with the spaceship. I agree. It's weird that they set up this, you know, visual of a rotating cylinder, which is obviously there to produce artificial gravity, and then totally ignore it once they get to the battle room. I'm almost more okay with it when they just sort of invent some gravity producing device and never explain it, like on Star Trek or Battlestar Galactica. You know, it's like, okay, it's just a thing they've invented. They're not going to tell us about it, but I'll believe it. But here they tried to do both, and I didn't like that.
Yeah, it's one of those things I find that, especially with experts like us, that when there's something that's sort of in our area or something we've played around with, because you've had the opportunity to take a look at rotating space habitats, and we'll get to that, I think, when we talk about where the movie gets things right. But when it's close to our own expertise, it can really great if it's not quite right. And I think one thing that really drove me nuts was, you know, that the problem started even before you get to the space station down on the ground with the launch site. So I don't know where to begin with this. I mean, clearly you've got a chemical rocket here, but there's no way that particular spacecraft can contain all of the fuel it needs to get to orbit the way it's depicted. Why would you launch necessarily from a temperate region that's further from the equator where you get the most push? You know, there's just so much here. You know, I don't want to be the person who cleans all of those solar panels. Goodness, you know, why would you launch in an area where there's sensitive equipment that could be, you know, damaged or destroyed?
I think the answer is it looked nice.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's a beautiful setting in the mountains. Again, I think this is British Columbia. Again, movies love British Columbia because it is beautiful. If you've never been to British Columbia, you should totally visit. It's one of the prettiest places on Earth. So that's why they picked it. But John's right. You know, the shuttle looked about the size, same size as the space shuttle, but the space shuttle had an enormous external fuel tank on the side in order to get it into orbit. And that was totally missing here. And then you're in a valley surrounded by mountains. If you have any issue on launch, you're going to crash into one of those mountains, right? This is the reason that people launch from places like Florida. Because as you launch, you would go into the ocean where you're not going to hit anybody or anything. And so you might have a slightly better chance at survival. The other issue is that this launch site appears to be further north than you'd normally expect. There's snow on the mountains. It does not look like it's equatorial. And launching from an equatorial site is preferred because you get a little bit of a boost from the Earth's own rotation. And so again, that's why you see a lot of these launch sites closer to the equator than not. this is not entirely true, right? In Russia, they don't have a lot of places near the equator, so they do launch from relatively high latitudes. But again, they're not in a valley surrounded by mountains. They're in a huge blank plain, so if anything happens, they would not run into anything. So it just seemed like, other than a beautiful spot, there didn't seem like a good reason to have the launch site in this mountainous valley.
It's almost a little too remote, but not remote enough in some ways, because if you imagine that you get to the point where rocket launches to orbit are as common as, say, aircraft takeoffs and landings, then, you know, I would kind of expect that you'd have these kinds of sites very near to cities so that people could then have a convenience. And the risk is actually controlled, because airplanes, of course, used to be very dangerous things, but now they fly over built-up areas all the time. But this is kind of in that sort of middle ground a little bit. It seems to be in a remote place that they need to take time to get to, but at the same time, it's not taking all those safeguards. It's not getting the, you know, little extra boost. So I don't know, it just sort of grates a little bit on my brain, I think.
I agree.
So we also have, of course, something that I think is going to become a theme on this show. So maybe the last thing before we talk about where the science really shines through, and that's timeline problems. Mm. And poor Mulder last week and his his rocket ship. But here we have a really strange situation as well. And the funny thing is, this is a place where the movie chose to diverge from the book a little bit. In general, the movie actually follows the book fairly closely. But what they did was, instead of perhaps putting the command school, that final test, on Ceres, here it's in another solar system. And not only do they make the distance you have to travel even further, but they also reduce the time from years to 28 days. And of course, Ender's a little bit upset. You know, he did kill a kid. And so he spends a couple of weeks taking a bit of a vacation within those 28 days before he gets loaded into a faster than light spaceship and sent off to another solar system. If the transit really is that short, I don't know why he needs the cryosleep, to be frank. But it's just one of these little things, these little timeline things that just drive us nuts.
I agree. And it's unnecessary, right? In the book, there are years that Ender is trained, you know, and they make a point of that, of him growing up and getting older. And this movie seems to be packed into, I don't know, a few months, which is unrealistic for a number of different reasons. The timeline problems you point out with, you know, just getting to another solar system, but also how would he learn all of that, you know, those skills and that strategy that he needs in order to command an army over the course of several months, right? That's also pretty unrealistic. I guess they just didn't want to show some kid growing up into a teenager. I don't know. I mean, obviously movies have their limitations, but they could have smoothed over some of those timeline issues by simply not announcing, you know, how many days it would take to get to the Formic homeworld.
Exactly. It's sort of, if you know, you know. If you've read the book, you can understand that. And you realize, you know, with child actors, that unless you're going to have a production that lasts for 10 years, that it's not going to be able to do that. Or you do a lot of swap outs of actors. Some movies do that, where yes, they need to show folks growing up. So after the break, we're going to come back and talk a little bit about the things, the science that really impressed us. Because you might have the impression right now that maybe we don't love the science so much in this one, but there are definitely places where Ender's Game gets it right. So we'll be back in just a minute. All right, welcome back. So there's definitely a few places where the science really shined in this particular movie. And there are some places where we knew it was going to be held to account. So there are definitely things we didn't like about the battle room. The way you get into it, you know, that doesn't really work well, physically speaking. But the physics that happens while you're in the battle room in zero G, that I thought was done much better.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was really tricky to get these kid actors to do all the zero G moves, for lack of a better word. It sounds like they were training the kids in the zero G maneuvers, much like the kids in Ender's Game were being trained in battle mechanics. But as John points out, it did turn out pretty well. I mean, I don't know all the movie magic that went into it. Presumably they were suspended from wires and whatnot on a green screen. But yeah, a lot of the cause and effect you might expect to see in a zero G environment, they did pretty well.
Yeah, it's a lot of those things that we almost always just see illustrated on blackboards, you know, with momentum, with, you know, objects in rest staying at rest and those in motion staying in motion and, you know, trading off angular momentum. It's really nice to see some of that done quite well. And just the very simple idea of what one's perception is, what one's orientation is in space, and that when you're in zero gravity, that can really be anything. I mean, that's the tagline right there. You know, the enemy's gate is down. I mean, that was a big thing for a long time. I had a license plate holder in grad school that said that, you know, just, you know, to show my proper nerd credentials here. So I think that was done really quite well.
Yeah, and some other issues with zero gravity were also done reasonably well. So as they're getting into the space shuttle to go up to battle school, one of the kids gets sick, and they have to pass him a barf bag, and, you know, and the vomit is coming out of the bag. You know, it's kind of a silly moment. But this is very, very common in space travel. I looked it up, and apparently 60 to 80% of space travelers experience this sort of space sickness during their first days in microgravity. So it's almost a wonder that more kids weren't sick, because this is a very common phenomenon, unless they gave them some sort of anti-nausea medication in advance, which is actually pretty common with astronauts on Earth. But, you know, they're still not entirely sure what causes this issue. There's two main, I guess, competing hypotheses from what I could read. One is that the fluids in your body shift around once you're in space. You'll notice that astronauts often have very puffy faces, as, you know, now their heart isn't trying to pump blood up to their brains. You know, it's a lot easier to do that in zero gravity. So all those fluids sort of build up in their faces that otherwise would have been drained due to gravity. And so there's some thought that maybe the shift in fluids might alter inner ear pressure and cause that nauseous feeling. The other theory that I was more familiar with is that basically, as John just mentioned, there is no up and down in space. It can be whatever you want it to be. And our brains and our inner ears are very much, you know, tuned in to having a strict up and down in a gravity environment. And so getting rid of that can really confuse your inner ear and might induce motion sickness.
Definitely. And I mean, it's a reason why they make the selection. A lot of people, when they're thinking about future space exploration, try to take that zero G element out of the story. And so you see a lot of different rotating habitats. So sometimes you get rings, sometimes you get something that's just being swung around, or there's even the classic O'Neill habitats, which are cylinders that are turned on their axis. But those have to be really big to not create different kinds of ways of getting sick. So I understand you looked at this a little bit in another life.
I did. So when I was in the 10th grade, I did a science fair project, and I invented a space station for my science fair project. I called it Space Station Terra Nova, which means, you know, new world. It was also the name of my dog at the time. We called her Tara. And so, yeah, I got out, you know, the styrofoam and the popsicle sticks and the Legos, and I constructed a space station. And I looked up, you know, the physics behind it. How big would it have to be in order to produce 1G of gravity? You know, how fast would it have to rotate so as not to induce other issues, like John was mentioning? There are these, they're called artificial forces. They are real forces, but you only encounter them in rotating reference frames. And so things like the Coriolis force, which could cause you to kind of get shifted one way or the another along your path. So you're walking in a straight line and suddenly, you know, you get shoved to the right or the left, depending on the direction of rotation. If you're going too fast, these are going to become issues. And so you have to make a big enough space station that's rotating slow enough in order to both give you enough gravity, but also not make you sick not cause you to veer off course when you're trying to walk. So this all works in theory. And I looked quite closely at the size and the rotation rate of the cylinder they had in Ender's Game. And from what I can tell, it's rotating at about 2 RPM rotations per minute, which should be slow enough that you're not going to get those adverse effects from the Coriolis force. But it's also big enough that you should be producing 1G of gravity. So I thought that was really impressive. I mean, this is all estimates. I guessed that the shuttle was about the same size as the space shuttle, which is 37 meters, and used that to make my estimate for the size of the cylinder, which is it seemed to have a circumference of about a mile. And then coupled with the rotation rate, that should produce 1G of gravity. So this was, like I said, this was the subject of my 10th grade science fair. I had mixed results at the science fair in Penticton, British Columbia, where I went to a high school. I did really well at the local level, and then the regional level, I'm not sure anyone understood what I was talking about. And so my science fair career ended there. But I also simultaneously applied for a space station contest sponsored by NASA. And even though the folks in Penticton didn't seem to understand what I was talking about, the folks at NASA liked it. So I did get a prize in that contest and was invited to visit NASA Ames Research Center, which is one of the many NASA centers, you know, scattered about the country. Last week, we talked about Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Ames is in California near San Francisco. And so I went there and I had a bit of a tour, and it was really fortunate. This was in 1997, which is the same time that Pathfinder landed on Mars. So that was July 4th, 1997, was our first lander on Mars since Viking, I think, in the 70s. So it'd been a long time since we'd gotten the lander to Mars, and everyone was very excited about this. If you're a space nerd kid out there, you know, apply to these opportunities, because it can be really inspiring and can help you, you know, with your future career.
Absolutely. And we'll be profiling a new NASA center every week here on the show. the real question people are wondering about, did they have an exobiology department?
Well, the NASA Astrobiology Institute was actually focused at Ames. Now, like I said last week, it doesn't exist anymore. But yeah, I mean, there was a lot of exobiology happening at Ames. So yes.
Very good. Very good. Something I do wonder sometimes is how many of those people who did really well in the science fair actually ended up being scientists in the end, because I haven't really encountered many people who've had that early preternatural kind of success in the professional scientist sort of core.
Yeah, I might be a bit of an unusual exception. I'm a pretty motivated person. And so, you know, any extracurricular activity that was presented to me as a child or as a teenager, I tended to take advantage of. I entered another contest in my senior year of high school. It was basically writing why Canada is great in space. It was for the Canadian Space Agency. But the wildest thing is they actually picked me, and I got to spend a summer in Houston, Texas at the age of 18, living with astronaut Chris Hadfield and his family. And I tell that story and it's like, wow, another life. Like, it was a dream that happened, but it did happen. I have pictures. But wow, what a great opportunity for, you know, an 18-year-old kid interested in space.
It's an interesting perspective, especially thinking about this movie, where you have these, you know, experienced spacefaring folks who are running this school for children who they hope will become military leaders, who are very steeped in, you know, the ins and outs of spacecraft and space travel and things like that. And that leads in very nicely, I think, to one of the things that I felt they did get right in this, which was the emphasis on psychology. Mm-hmm. So there's even, I mean, the second in command of this particular school, Major Anderson, played by Viola Davis, this particular person is essentially a psychologist. They're there to try to, you know, understand the progression of the students, you know, to push them hard, but not so hard that that they're broken. And throughout the whole course of the movie, I kind of feel like the psychology, the psychological aspect, the movie, the book, cares almost more about that than it does about, you know, things like the, you know, the physics and whatnot. The idea of going through this very difficult situation. And there's a little nod that I picked up on in the movie where that psychologist character points out, well, you know, it used to be a war crime to have anybody under 15 years old involved in training for the military or being a soldier of any kind.
Yeah, no, psychology is a really important aspect of astronaut selection. They put you through a battery of tests. Not that I've been through these tests. I don't want to be an astronaut. But certainly, you know, I did have met a lot of astronauts. You know, my summer in Houston alone, I met a large number of astronauts, and they were all so friendly. You know, you could tell that they had picked a certain sort of person that was very outgoing and but determined and driven. And so they all kind of had this similar personality, I think, chosen to be resilient in space in these difficult situations and also work well together with other folks while they were up there.
It definitely, it takes a certain kind, and I feel like it takes a different kind than sometimes gets portrayed in the movies when we're thinking about, you know, people who are going to space. There's, of course, a lot of the movies do focus on psychological breakdowns of crews in space, so there's always that one person who, you know, lied on their test and is totally unstable, which you probably wouldn't get.
Yeah, but so they make this point about having children, like, I think the idea is they don't know what they don't know, so they're not going to make all the same mistakes that an adult would because they'd be too cautious or they've seen too much. But I do wonder if kids are really the best commanders for a space force like they've portrayed here. But I guess as you know, as the movie points out, they treat it like a game. And so maybe if you're not actually considering that you're killing, you know, millions of sentient beings, maybe you can treat it like a game, and maybe kids are better at games than adults. It's certainly something they is pointed out quite a bit in this movie.
Yeah, the neuroplasticity would be very high for anyone of that age. And, you know, once you get to the point where you've got good coordination, that sort of, you know, spatial skill, I think would be very strong. But another bit that comes into this is, of course, the instructors are quite cruel to the children, and they say, well, it's because we need a new Alexander. So we're going to just, you know, push people in ways that, you know, outside of warfare would be considered completely unethical. But it's also true that the children are actually really quite cruel to one another, to the point where, you know, we've got our hero here. He doesn't know it, but one of the aspects of his character that makes him worthy of selection is this idea that, you know, he doesn't just, you know, win the current battle, he wins all the battles to come by absolutely obliterating his enemy, and that ends with two of the other children dead. So, at least in the book it does. In the movie, they leave that a little bit hazier, certainly. So, I don't know, I do wonder about this. I'm quite a bit older than when I first read the book, but I do wonder about that sort of moral sense and when that comes into children. And if you're talking about, you know, folks who are between, say, 6 and 12 years old, how much of an appreciation they have for the magnitude of the themes being talked about in this particular book. I have very little experience with small humans. I think you might have a little bit more, Catherine.
Yeah, so my son is going to be turning 6 next month, and, you know, imagining him in Ender's spot. So in the movie, he's clearly older than 6, but in the book, when he first goes to battle school, he's 6 years old. And I can tell you that my son has no concept of the morality of genocide, right? To him, you know, he just likes whacking people with a stick in a video game, right? It's all fun and games to him. You can tell that, you know, those higher order processing have not kicked in his brain just yet. So, I mean, I can believe it that you could convince a child of that age to play a game and win the game without them kind of understanding the deeper ramifications of what they're doing.
Yeah, it's true. And that last little bit where the curtain is drawn back, and it's like, it's not a game. This has all been real. You know, all of the people who've died, the planet that was destroyed, that all happened in real life. It's kind of interesting. I don't know that it's actually handled well in the movie, to be frank with you, because I mean, you can imagine, you know, a whole conflict of emotions with the older, you know, members of the military and the political side who are watching, you know, watching the game take place, and the kids themselves. And I'm not sure that knot really gets untangled in a satisfying way.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I thought the ending was a bit morally ambiguous. because the whole movie is about these kids doing well in these battle scenarios, which are presented as games. So in that way, it seems like it's praising, oh, Ender's such a good commander. He's such a good warrior. You know, look at these smart kids. They're great. But, you know, at the end, he kind of has this breakdown when he realized he just killed an entire race of sentient beings. And so you're meant to think, oh, war is bad. But it doesn't really decide on which it wants to be. Is it praising war or is it vilifying war? I didn't get a good sense at the end of which side they were on. I think this becomes more clear in future books, but they never made that sequel. I guess Ender's Game didn't do very well at the box office, so they never made a sequel. And so that answer is never clarified.
Indeed, and that's a challenge with making a movie that's so obviously set up for a sequel. And in fact, in the foreword in Ender's Game, the author, Orson Scott Card, mentions that the book that he wanted to write was the second book. It's Speaker for the Dead. But in order to do that, in order to set it up and to get the stakes out there, what he felt he had to do was to take his previous award-winning short story, Ender's Game, and expand that out to sort of novel length. So really, you know, his heart's in the second one. And in the second one, you know, we don't want to get too far off of the course here, but definitely Ender is not seen as a hero anymore by anyone, including himself.
Yeah, well, genocide is a hard thing to overcome. And he definitely genocided a whole planet, which is a bad thing, and it should be presented that way.
Indeed. So after the next little break, we'll talk a little bit about how this particular movie is as of its time. You know, has it aged well? What are the bigger surrounding issues about it? So we'll be right back. All right, welcome back. So in this segment, we're talking just a little bit about what the external forces were about Ender's Game. Has the way that it's presented aged well? What was going around, you know, in the wider world about the production, about the exhibition of it? And I think this is a book where, I keep saying book, this is a movie where there's a lot of those, you know, questions for us to ask. And to really dig our teeth into. We did finish the last section talking a little bit about, you know, war worship and whether that's something that doesn't get quite the treatment that it ought to towards the end. There's also a whole bunch of other little bits and pieces here. So, of course, for me, where I keep mistaking book and movie and whatnot, and it's hard to do that, this is, I think, an interesting place to start. Because movies and books are different things. They're different art. Even if they're made by the same person, they're going to not resemble one another. And it's difficult, especially with something that's well-loved or something that you encounter, I think, earlier in your childhood where it gets in a little bit deeper. The people that I know who read The Lord of the Rings at a really young age, I know many of them hate the films, the Peter Jackson films.
Wow.
Yeah, because
the films are the only reason I read the books. I could not get through the beginning.
I was much the same way. And I think what it is that it's the picture on screen doesn't look like the picture in their head. And they're unable to really, you know, reconcile that a little bit. So one thing that's interesting about Ender's Game is it's actually starting from a book that is quite short. So there's less that the director has to leave out. The movie itself is actually written by Orson Scott Card, so the screenplay.
No, it wasn't.
No?
They took it away from him. Yeah, the director ended up writing the screenplay.
Oh, they both got credits on there, so I hadn't realized that.
Oh, interesting. In the articles I read, it sounded like they didn't like where Card was going with it, so the director took over and wrote the screenplay.
Interesting, because there were, so one fun thing with this is there were copies of a screenplay that Card had written that were on the internet in the 90s.
Mm.
So, you know, there was definitely a lot of people who were excited about this. It was a very anticipated movie, even though it didn't do particularly well. And in fact, when I jumped on Reddit to take a look before here, I don't see a lot of people praising the movie. I mean, maybe a little culty, but not much. A lot of folks just were not happy with this particular realization. And we've talked about some of the ways in which the movie was different from the book. Always going to be some of that. I just find some of these things fascinating. My favorite example is 2001: A Space Odyssey, where you had Arthur C. Clarke writing the book at the same time that Stanley Kubrick was making the movie. And it turned out that Arthur C. Clarke got ahead of the movie. And so the book came out first. And in the book, they go to Iapetus, which is a satellite of Saturn's. And it is simultaneously the brightest and darkest thing in the solar system in many ways. Because there's carbon dioxide ice that moves around on its surface. So it's reflective when you're seeing the carbon dioxide ice, and it's dark when you're not. Apparently, the studio was not going to film, or was not going to pay Kubrick to go to Jupiter and to Saturn for the VFX in the late 60s. So instead, Europa got the monolith in the movie. And funnily enough, when Arthur C. Clarke went back and wrote sequels, he went with a movie version instead of his own book. So this interplay is fun, I think.
Yeah, but overall, I would say Ender's Game as a movie followed very closely to the book compared to other book-movie combos I've seen. So it's strange that people didn't like it more. Unlike John, I didn't read this book till my 20s, so I don't have like a really deep, you know, nostalgic connection with it. I think the movie is fine, you know, and it's pretty true to the book. It gives that, it brings it to life in a way and presents the messages that are clear in the book. So I don't know why people would like the book, but not the movie. It's unclear why it did so poorly at the box office. One possibility, though, is that over the years, Orson Scott Card, who wrote the book, has veered into some politics and has offended people as a result of his views. And so this movie came out in late 2013, and earlier that year, a group called for a boycott of the movie due to his views on same-sex marriage. And so a group called Geeks Out boycotted the film in protest of these views, and a number of people picked up this protest. And so perhaps between when the book was written in the 80s and when this came out in 2013, you know, people's views had changed, and maybe they didn't want to support an artist that didn't jive with their belief system. And he didn't really do himself many favors in responding to the controversy. There was a statement he released in July of 2013 to Entertainment Weekly. I'm going to read it here. He says, "Ender's Game is set more than a century in the future and has nothing to do with political issues that did not exist when the book was written in 1984. With the recent Supreme Court ruling, the gay marriage issue becomes moot. The full faith and credit clause of the Constitution will, sooner or later, give legal force in every state to any marriage contract recognized by any other state. Now it will be interesting to see whether the victorious proponents of gay marriage will show tolerance toward those who disagreed with them when the issue was still in dispute." So, you know, maybe not the message you want to send to fans that are upset with your political views. A couple of things here that are wrong with this statement. The political issues did exist in 1984. I mean, same-sex marriage has always been an issue. And in 1984, like even more so, because people couldn't get married. And why would you show tolerance to somebody with an intolerant view? So I don't think he really got it. And so, you know, people who might have enjoyed his book as a child perhaps were soured by these political views he had that were not consistent with where society has headed.
Yeah, it's an interesting question here, you know, and one that often comes up where you have this question of, you know, the value of the art versus the artist. If the artist is odious, but the art that's created, you know, seems to have some value, how do you separate those two, you know, and the way in which that art gets consumed? Certainly, Ender's Game was very influential on a whole generation of smart kids, myself included. And I think for a lot of us, it was because it felt really personal. So you've got, you know, somebody who's obviously intelligent, who's being, you know, essentially forced by the adults in their life to perform. That sounds very familiar. And you know, for many young smart kids, it can be kind of a lonely place, it can be a bit of a lonely upbringing. So this is one of those books where, you know, almost it's not so much the plot as the feeling that you get from it, you know, that, you know, you feel a certain kinship, I think, with Ender. But when you get to the 2013 movie, you know, there's that emphasis on Orson Scott Card and his views, and you're also viewing it from the outside, I think. That's one of the challenges. It's the kind of book that if you're filming it, you cannot really film from a first-person perspective, not easily. And so, you know, it's a bit more remote, and it makes it feel a little bit different.
Yeah, they said that was one of the things they struggled with in the screenplay, is a lot of the book takes place in Ender's head. You're seeing his thoughts as an omnipotent reader, whereas that wouldn't work in a movie. So they had to try to write dialogue between him and other characters to sort of, you know, reveal his state of mind, which you wouldn't need in a book. And so it perhaps was a little clunky there.
And just the fact of being older, I think, right? Like we like to imagine, you know, Catherine, you and I and everyone, that, you know, we're the same person that we always were. We've always been this way, you know, that, you know, me of 10 or 20 or 30 years ago is the same, essentially, me today. But really, over time, you know, we change and we become different and we, you know, learn and we adapt. And I think part of the challenge with a piece of work like this is people consumed it as children. Now they're not children. And now they're seeing that childlike perspective that they might not recognize anymore.
That's right. So perhaps maybe children shouldn't be warriors because their brains haven't fully developed. Coming back to that topic.
Agreed. So let's talk about the internet, because, you know, that has a bit of a role in the movie, despite the fact that most of the internet related things in the book were removed. No comment.
Yeah, so this is another issue with the book versus the movie. So in the book, well, also in the movie, Ender has two siblings, an older brother, Peter, and an older sister, Valentine. And there's this whole subplot in the book where they take on these, you know, fake personas to try to sway political opinion on basically an early version of the internet. Right. So this book, as I mentioned, was written in 1984. The internet, as we know it, did not exist in 1984. And so, but they had this huge subplot with these two children, you know, pretending to be adults, you know, espousing political views in order to shift people's opinions. So, you know, I read another interview with Orson Scott Card, and he says that people give me a lot of credit for having predicted the internet. If you look at the first copyright date, I wasn't really predicting. However, my one prediction was that as soon as the web became open to the public, networks would become politically important. It took a while before they were, but that one I got right. And I think that's definitely true today. You know, the rise of social media has swayed people's political opinions far more than I think anyone was expecting. And they do represent that in the book.
Absolutely. And it, to be honest with you, in the book, it seems mild. It's very much marketplace of ideas, and you know, people are being convinced by the soaring rhetoric of these two genetically engineered kids. And what we see, I think, out there in the social media landscape today, politically, is just so much different. It's much more misinformation and things being, you know, warped into this funhouse mirror, and every single opinion being, you know, having places where it's affirmed no matter how crazy. And it seems like while the general idea of these networks being politically important, that has rung true, the way in which they become politically important is very different. And I don't know anybody who predicted the insanity that we live in today.
No, it's a really unfortunate side effect that I don't think anyone predicted. Even in the 90s, I was very active in online forums and in discussions with strangers on the internet in the 90s. But this was before Facebook, right? And the tone was just different. People were not as cruel to each other. There was more in-depth discussion, more fleshing out of ideas than the sort of misinformation that John was talking about that we see today. And I don't know exactly why or how that happened, but honestly, I think social media has been a net negative for humanity.
I'm with you on that. Well, let's end with a little bit of a fun note here before we go on to the ratings. The battle arena, it's, I think, instantly recognizable. It reminds me so much of Tron, I have to say, the way that things are lit. I don't know that I've been to as many laser tag arenas as you have, Catherine, but that I know sparked in your mind.
Yeah, it just reminded me of one of these, I don't know what to call them, but activity places that children go. And if you've ever done laser tag with the silly little suits that you have on and the guns that you can shoot people with, it was hard to take the battle room seriously when it looked like a laser tag arena. And I don't know if that's of its time or, just the consequences of the limitations of movie magic, but yeah, it was a bit, you could see why children would like it, I guess.
Definitely, and I think it screams, game, right? Like that, you can't take an environment like that seriously.
Right. So how does it hold up though over time? So each week we're going to rate our movie or television show based on its scientific accuracy, how much influence it's had over time, and then how it holds up. Compared to when it was published or produced to today. So let's kick things off by rating it on its science accuracy. John, how well did this movie do?
So I've rated out of a possible five. This one is a bit of a two to me. I remember it as being, very accurate when I was reading the book, and then I remember the movie felt different. Now, upon rewatching it, I think I'm more bothered by the gripes than the places where it shines through. So I've got to give it less than half on this one.
Wow, 2 out of 5. That's low. I was actually more impressed than I was expecting to be regarding the scientific accuracy. When I worked out the rotation rate and the size of that cylinder, I was shocked that it actually produced, one gravity. I was not expecting that to be true. I thought, oh, there's no way they did that correctly. And so the fact that they did that right bumped it up in my estimation. A couple of gripes though, the whole jumping from 1G to 0G bothered me. A couple of little things about the concept of the aliens. So I'm going to give it a 3 out of 5 for this week.
Expectations really matter for this, don't they? Like how
I
you're
think they
going into
do.
it.
Yeah, I had very low expectations, I guess. How about its influence? How much has it influenced you? How much has it influenced society? What would you rank it there, John?
So this is interesting, right? Because with influence, I'm thinking about the movie, not about the Enderverse in general, not about Ender's Game, the book, but just the movie. Because the book, I feel, was quite influential. But the movie, I think the movie fell really flat. So again, we mentioned it did not do well at the box office. So a planned TV show and a planned sequel never happened. And even today, when I go out and take a look on the internet, I see more people upset with the movie than people re-embracing it. It doesn't seem to quite get to that campy stage that, say, the first Dune movie had, which was often, watched late at night, in like math camps and stuff like that, which I may or may not have been a part of. So the movie itself, I almost want to give it a zero. It is not without influence, but I didn't think that it had very much. So I give it a one.
I tend to agree with you. I couldn't even remember if I'd seen this movie when I rewatched it. I think I did see it. I had a very young child at the time, so my memory is pretty hazy from 2013 onward. But the fact that I could barely remember it, and it seems to have had very little influence on society as a whole, I tend to agree with John, although I'll give it a two. I think I was taking into account the book a little bit there as well. All right, lastly, okay, it's been 12 years now, or roughly that, since it was came out on the big screen. How does it hold up, John?
So it doesn't feel dated. Like there are definitely movies and TV shows and whatnot where you can say, that movie, if it was made today, would not do well. Of course, this one didn't do great at the time, but I don't feel like it would do significantly worse currently. I think that there is nothing that was right then and that is wrong now. It continues to be pretty much what it is. And so I think for me, that merits over 12 years a better than average score. So I'll give it a 3.5.
Yep, again, we're in agreement here. It's still a good movie to watch. The special effects aren't laughable. It looks like a modern movie. Even Harrison Ford never seems to age somehow. So I will agree with you and give it a 3 out of 5 for how it holds up.
It is pretty crazy, all of the people they got to be a part of this. It is, like an embarrassment of stars are in this particular movie, which makes it seem even all the stranger that it didn't really amount to much.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Ben Kingsley, I mean, did an amazing job as Maser Rackham. Yeah, I don't know why this movie bombed as much as it did, but clearly it did, and we're not even remembering it today. So bad news for Ender's Game. Maybe we'll have better luck next week. So join us next time with a new movie or television show to discuss. Thanks for listening, and remember, it's just basic rocket science, people.
And don't forget that the enemy's gate is down. Popcorn Science is hosted by Catherine Niche and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.